for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The financial regulatory reform bill signed into law last month attempts to resolve many issues, but not, some say, one of the thorniest, the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In 2008, the federal government stepped in to save these quasi-government entities from collapse. Since then, the housing industry has become increasingly reliant on the guarantees, and taxpayers have been footing the bill. Joining me to talk about the government's role in the U.S. housing market, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. He's an economist, former director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2006. Sarah Rosen-Wartell of the Center for American Progress, and Linda Couch of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Of course, your comments are always an important part of the program. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Sarah Rosen-Wartell, I wonder if you would start by telling us what this meeting today is all about, what's under discussion, and what do you expect to be the outcome?
Well, this morning they called together experts from the investment community, the affordable housing community, the mortgage banking industry, and a whole panoply of different interests to talk about what the future design of the housing finance system ought to be and how we get there from here. Secretary Geithner laid out four important questions in his opening remarks that I think are a good assessment. And they are looking, as they answer these questions, both at the past, because it tells us important things about what went wrong and what the system should look like in the future. So he asked what role government should play for stability in the housing market. What is the role the government should play in advancing affordable housing? He identified the Dodd-Frank bill as playing an important role in regulating mortgage products and wanted this discussion to guide their implementation. And then he identified the importance of managing the transition. And Secretary Donovan went on to talk more about particularly the role of affordable housing and the impact of the crisis on the on American communities. So that's the framework, and the process will be this hearing today where they will listen and ask questions, a series of four more hearings around the country later this fall. And then the Dodd-Frank bill had a statutory mandate that the president make recommendations to the Congress in early 2010. So I would suspect that sometime in January, before or after his budget, you will see proposal from the administration, probably in the form of a white paper, much like you saw how they began the discussion about financial regulatory reform.
So realistically, this is the first of four meetings. At the end of those four meetings, is it too much to expect that we would really have the beginnings of financial reform?
I think it's fair to say that they're fully committed to offering a vision on how you get there from here that will require significant legislation. I don't think it'll be legislation that will be easy to pass in the Congress, so there will inevitably be a significant debate. And then whatever that legislation, whenever that legislation is enacted, it will inevitably involve a transition and a glide path. Because today, 96% of the housing market has some kind of backstop, either, I should say homeownership, it's not the whole market, but 96% of single-family housing has backstop either from FHA, VA, and Ginnie Mae, or from the GSEs in conservatorship. And that's an unsustainable situation that no one wants to preserve, but will have to be done gradually so there's not significant macroeconomic and even global economic consequences if
Sarah
you do it wrong.
Sarah Rosen-Wartell of the Center for American Progress. Doug Holtz-Aiken, talk about how Fannie and Freddie function before 2008, and from your vantage point, what you would expect their function to be once this process has been completed.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were created for a good purpose. Fannie Mae was created for community banks, Freddie Mac for savings and loans. And the idea was to get away from the American experience where a little community bank in the middle of the farmlands held all the mortgages of everyone in that area. When the crop goes bad, everyone defaults at the same time. Down goes the bank. Instead, in this system, Fannie Mae would buy up those mortgages, give cash back to the bank. It could make new loans and thus provide a greater ability to provide mortgages in the United States. And by buying up those mortgages, Fannie Mae could sell off packages of them, some pieces from Iowa, some pieces from Nebraska, some pieces from Pennsylvania, to investors, and thereby spread the risk of a housing default across the nation and get away from this compartmentalized system.
Sounds like a good plan, but what went wrong?
What went wrong was they took that business, which was securitization, a good idea, and a government guarantee of those securities to make sure investors would be interested in it, and they went into a second line of business, which is a hedge fund, which borrowed with the implicit backing of the U.S. taxpayer, so it got to borrow cheaply, and invested in risky stuff. In fact, the risky stuff it invested in was largely its own. It was all housing-related, and there's no more risky thing to do than to take a very highly leveraged bet on a single asset. And they did it in spades, and we're paying for it.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he's an economist, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. Linda Couch, what is your greatest concern about the low-income housing market in light of these recommendations toward revision of Fannie and Freddie?
Well, we're extremely optimistic that there will be a serious reform of the housing finance system. And our greatest concerns have to do with the population that we feel has been historically and quite seriously left behind by the housing finance system. And by that, I mean people with the very lowest incomes, people who traditionally must rely on affordable rental housing to make their lives workable. And, you know, we hope that this reform leads to an overall policy goal gets back to the promise, really, of the 1949 Housing Act, which was a decent home and an affordable living environment for every American family. And so our concerns lie with those left behind. And, you know, the data are quite clear that when you line up all the extremely low-income households, and then you line up all of the apartments that are affordable to them, there's an absolute shortage of rental units by about 3 million units to that extremely low-income group. And we hope that this reform can bring about ways to bring financing with federal incentives and federal guarantees to provide more multifamily housing to that lowest income group.
Is that realistic, Sarah?
Well, yes. But I think it's important to understand that the gap that Linda was just describing is really in two forms. One is, and I completely agree, that we had the balance wrong on finance policy. We didn't focus enough on ensuring that there is available housing stock and financing to make that possible. We face in this country, notwithstanding the current downturn in the economy, in the long term, growth in the sectors of the economy of people who tend to rely on home ownership. Those are lower and moderate income people, and with immigrants, our population is going to continue to grow and demand more rental housing. We face probably a number of people who were formerly homeowners who will be in rental housing for an extended period of time. So demands for rental housing are going to only grow. While we've seen a stall out in the supply actually over 20 years, and then right now with the constraint in credit even more so. So we're going to see a gap between supply and demand, and that'll mean prices will only rise and the affordability problems Linda described will get worse. So I think that it is important we focus on that. But it is also the case that housing finance system will not solve all of the problem Linda described, because the income gap, even if you provide affordable finance, the gap between what rents cost and housing, and we need a broader balanced housing policy to address that problem as well.
When you say a broader balanced housing policy. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that we need to make sure that we are thinking about income support where it's necessary to make sure that there's decent housing and support for the production of low-income housing, which will inevitably involve some form of subsidy to get a sufficient rental stock so we don't see people assuming that their only route to a decent home is to stretch beyond their means into homeownership.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is right, and I think it's important for our listeners to think about this in three different steps that get intermingled. The first is the ability to afford shelter and whether policies should provide income support to people in order to meet the rents in their area or whether it should be subsidies to building shelter. But the question is, can people afford shelter? The second step is, do they own that shelter or do they rent it? And we have had a traditional bias in the U.S. to pushing people to own that shelter that mystifies most economists, myself included, and which has produced a lot of difficulties. Then the third step is, if you're going to own, how do you finance that ownership? Do you put in your savings and equity invest, or do you borrow some or all of it? And that's the corner in which the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, have lived for a long time, the housing finance of owner-occupied housing. We have bigger problems. Enough shelter that's affordable, whether you own versus rent it and getting the policies right there. And then the third step, financing effectively home ownership when people borrow money. And I think that, you know, when Sarah talks about a broader housing policy, one would hope that that's the discussion we'd have. Let's break this into the right pieces and do it sensibly.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he's an economist, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking about a conference that is underway as we speak, looking at the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, looking at the entire housing industry and how it might be affected with changes in the financial system as a result of the collapse of both Freddie and Fannie, the whole housing market. Here in the studio, Sarah Rosen-Mortell at the Center for American Progress, Linda Couch of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and Douglas Holtz-Aiken, economist. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2006. As a result of this conference, the first of four beginning today, how do you see Fannie and Freddie changing? Will they remain entities? Will their roles change? How do you see it, Sarah?
I think there's a relatively broad-based assumption that there will be some institutions in the future which will provide a narrow, targeted guarantee on the mortgage-backed securities that represent individual homes and rental housing.
Narrow.
It would be, my belief is that what will result is a guarantee on the securities, but not on the corporate debt or equity of these whatever entities emerge. And whether or not what the transition involves essentially dissolving Fannie and Freddie, winding them down and creating something new, or whether they are turned into this perhaps with other competitors in the market. They will operate under completely different ground rules, and I think the assets of those institutions, not only the loans that they have in their portfolio now, which the new ones are actually relatively good and performing well, but also the human capital and systems are important assets that will inevitably be redeployed in the new system in some form.
Doug, how do you see it?
Well, I hope we see massive reforms, but the notion of reforming Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is the congressional equivalent of the check is in the mail. We hear it all the time, but it hasn't happened. Going forward, there's no place for them. They are institutions that have outlived their historic usefulness. There's no evidence that we need special efforts to get investment capital into the housing sector in the United States. If anything, we have too much of our capital invested in housing.
So you want to see the government get completely out of the housing sector, except within the FHA, perhaps?
There's a place for low-income support. But that should be targeted on low-income households, not on the debt of particular kinds of mortgages. And the guarantee is a debatable issue as well. I mean, it's a subsidy to debt-financed housing in the United States. Do we really want to subsidize debt-financed housing? I don't think so.
Linda.
Well, we definitely see a role for something like Fannie or Freddie in the future in whatever the new system is. And as Sarah said, you know, we need really stringent ground rules for how those entities operate. But the thought of moving to a totally private system, we think, would really exacerbate the current problems.
Why?
Well, we think that on the whole, the private sector has failed to address the housing needs of the lowest income households. And we think that there need to be incentives and contributions from those entities that will benefit from borrowing from the Federal Reserve, from the home loan banks, and that there needs to be some reciprocity in those benefits provided by the public to a public benefit.
But Linda, I want to go back to your earlier statement, going back to 1949, mm-hmm. and the statement that the American dream was home ownership. Do you see that changing radically?
Well, I don't think that the American dream, as stated in 49, was home ownership, but was a decent home. And over the last 75 years, that has been morphed by rhetoric into home ownership. And we should be caring much less about how people hold on to their housing, but much more so as to whether people are housed at all. You know, homelessness for families in rural and suburban areas has increased by 56% over the last year.
56%.
The Secretary of HUD made that announcement in March. And so in addition to income supports, you know, rental assistance vouchers, raising people's wages, we need to focus on production. And the private market, because there's no profit there, is not involved in producing homes for this income group. And so we need to figure out a way to invest significant new dollars into that arena.
Linda Couch, the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's a question from Facebook. Please have your guests address the myth that the housing crisis started with or because of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, when in fact they were following the path of the private banking industry. Sarah.
I think your commenter is absolutely right. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made enormous mistakes. They essentially were late to the party, and then when the rest of the investors were getting out, they inexplicably doubled down. But the underlying imbalance...
When you say they doubled down, what you mean is that they got to the party late and then started buying up all these bad mortgages.
Well, they did two things. The first of all, you have to look at their business is to buy loans from lenders and issue mortgage-backed securities. And they did that. And while over time their underwriting standards eroded as they tried to compete in the market with these ridiculous subprime products, the real expense to the taxpayers, or a significant part of it, is coming from their investment in private label securities. And those, they essentially purchased the competitor to their own product. And those private label securities essentially were part of a separate funding channel. We call it the shadow banking system of unregulated lenders originating subprime products rated by rating agencies who rated them without regard to the quality of the underlying mortgages. And there was a ridiculous race to the bottom. And then large customers of Fannie and Freddie said, either you originate and purchase product like this, or we're going to take our business elsewhere. And they saw their market share fall almost in half as this channel exploded over 30 years.
But in today's Wall Street Journal, an op-ed piece by former Fannie Mae credit officer Edward Pinto says that the crisis was in large part brought on because the mortgage finance industry was forced to abandon traditional underwriting standards. Doug, do you agree with that?
There is no question that traditional underwriting standards evaporated in the United States, and an enormous number of terrible mortgages were originated. These are not creditworthy borrowers. And the issue becomes, to what extent did government policy drive that occurrence? And Mr. Pinto's point is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were given not only a privilege, which was to buy these securities using taxpayer backing, essentially, and make a lot of money in the process, they were given an obligation to meet affordable housing goals. A certain fraction of those purchases had to be mortgages for those which were deemed to be affordable housing borrowers. And if you look at the data, it's clear that they start bumping up against the problem that they can't get enough of these things to meet their statutory requirements. And that means they have to lower their credit standards and buy mortgages they would not otherwise to meet the affordable housing goals. And it goes right along with the deterioration in lending standards elsewhere in the industry. And Sarah's narrative's nice, but I don't think it conveniently fits all the facts. I think there's a heavy contribution by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to this crisis. And it's evidence, I think most importantly going forward, that if you want to have affordable housing goals, and I think Americans have a shared value of making sure that people can be in shelter they can afford, doing it through the narrow confines of how you finance debt is a terrible way to get there. We ought to think more broadly about the policy.
Linda.
I just wanted to make a comment that I think that, you know, the deterioration of lending standards coincided, unfortunately, with the deterioration and a significant loss of affordable housing in the United States. You know, over the last 15 years, as lending became much looser, we lost several hundred thousand units of publicly subsidized and affordable housing. And it wasn't necessarily because the nation couldn't afford to maintain and provide new housing. And so in addition to reforming Fannie and Freddie, I really hope that this reform discussion takes into account the reform of direct subsidies and tax expenditures, federal appropriations to housing through things like homeownership subsidies. Right now, we spend about $300 billion on housing subsidies, but 80% of that goes to homeowner subsidies through things like the mortgage interest deduction and capital gains tax breaks, and only 20% to housing programs for the very lowest income people. So in addition to balancing the Fannie and Freddie and how well they work with rental housing versus homeownership, we also have to look at direct federal spending and tax expenditures.
So what you're saying is that those with the most expensive houses, the highest mortgages,
they benefit,
are getting the biggest benefit.
By far, those people benefit the most. As right now, you can have a mortgage interest deduction on a mortgage up to $1 million. And so the people who can afford the highest mortgages will get the largest tax breaks. And so we would like to see some rebalancing of the mortgage interest deduction policies. And at the end of the day, really directing our scarce federal resources to the people most in need of shelter.
One comment here from email. Please make it clear in the language you use that subsidy means taxpayers pay for it. There is not universal agreement that we, the taxpayers, should be subsidizing housing, and certainly not home ownership for other people.
Diane, I want to I think that the caller is right, that that's what subsidy means, although I want to be clear that in the system of the future, it is possible to provide taxpayer backing that is priced, that we get a fee paid that will cover the catastrophic risk of a failure of one of these entities. And it was create like an FDIC insurance fund on the books of the taxpayer to cover the risk of failure of these entities. That's one of the major flaws that we had in the system of the fact.
But didn't Sheila Bair at the FDIC warn of this very problem months before it happened?
Well, she and many others were warning of the crisis in the quality of underwriting, as Doug mentioned earlier, for honestly years. And one of the real flaws is that the regulators were asleep at the switch during the Bush administration.
Or deaf.
Certainly not hearing what many people were saying, because there was a belief in the sort of unfettered private market was going to create wealth. And in this case, what it did was destroy it.
Sarah Rosen-Wardell at the Center for American Progress. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Doug.
Sarah has just given a wonderful textbook blackboard explanation of something one could do. Forget it. It won't happen, because one of the things the federal government does worst is manage risk. It can't run pension benefit guarantee programs. It can't run flood insurance programs. It never charges the right fee for the risk it incurs. And there's absolutely no evidence that we need to be providing this guarantee. What we may need to do is help some people afford their apartment or home. We do not need to provide this guarantee, which was a subsidy that Fannie and Freddie largely passed on not to borrowers of mortgages, but to their shareholders, where they made enormous profits. This is a business the federal government should get out of, not into in a different way.
If we do get out, Diane, though, what we will lose is the availability of long-term fixed-rate finance for all American homeowners. The key thing that this targeted guarantee in the future should be available for, and much more better regulated so that the value of the guarantee goes to the homeowners. But the thing that's important is the idea that you can borrow a house and know what's going to cost you over the life of the loan. All the evidence is clear from other foreign countries as well as our own history that when the private sector offers finance, it only offers it for a short period of time. And American families need certainty. The risk of default on adjustable rate mortgages, even before this crisis, was twice that of prime mortgages to comparable borrowers. We need to be sure that we have in our system a way for families to predict what their housing costs will be.
Linda, you mentioned homelessness. Why is it, or let me put it another way, is it true that in Europe, homelessness is at a minimal rate? And if so, why in comparison to the U.S.?
It is true that in Europe that homelessness happens at a much, you know, less rate than it does in the United States. And I think part of that is because we've really fallen off the track when it comes to providing subsidized housing. And there,
are you saying that that's what Europe does?
Well, European countries on the whole provide more social housing, more subsidized housing, and better income support. So you can do two things. You can create affordable housing. You can produce it. You can preserve that which exists today. Or you can provide people the resources in their own pockets to bridge the gap between what they can afford and what it actually costs to own housing, or you can increase their income altogether so that they don't need a subsidy at all. And I think Europe has a much better combination of all of those things than the United States has.
Now, will the four-period conference that's going to take place over the next year address some of those issues?
Well, we certainly hope it does, and we hope that it ends up where things like the National Housing Trust Fund, which was established by Congress 2 years ago to produce and preserve housing for extremely low-income households, would receive funding, not just from Fannie and Freddie, as originally was designated by Congress, but by whatever these new entities are, and certainly by other financial institutions.
And, Doug, do you see Fannie and Freddie going down?
Oh, I think there is no future for them in the American housing finance system. This is a business model that was deeply broken. Private investors made a lot of money because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac received a variety of protections. They had the ability to sell unlimited amounts of their securities to banks in ways that other competitors could not. They got the ability to have a line of credit at the Treasury. They had presidential appointees to their boards. They were perceived to be an entity of the government. And we ended up paying for this in a very big way.
And Sarah, do you see it going down?
I don't think we will see those institutions in their current form in the future system, but I think we need to have a system that has different support.
Sarah Rosen-Wardell, she's with the Center for American Progress. When we come back, it's your turn to ask the questions. Join us on 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Two professors examine the American higher education system and give it an F. They say rising college tuition does not translate into better education. They explain how students and parents can get the most for their money. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. It's time to open the phones, first to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Al. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, sir.
In the initial statement made by your guest explaining our current situation where they bundled these mortgages from various parts of the country, there's another very important factor that's responsible for our current financial downfall. And that's the insurance of those loans by AIG. The insurance of those loans would not have been permitted when the bucket shop law was on the books. The bucket shop law was established in 1907 after the Depression. It was removed from the books by President Clinton, and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner were the ones who promoted the removal of the bucket shop law.
What's the bucket shop law, Doug?
I'm going to confess I have no idea.
I've never heard of the bucket shop law, Al.
The bucket shop law and the was enacted in 1907 after the Great Depression. At that time,
Great Depression. Wait a minute. The Great Depression did not occur until 1929.
I think, though, your caller, Diane, is talking about a concern that is real, which is that the capital markets began taking these private label securities we were talking about before and slicing and dicing the risk, and essentially through a series of tranching and what they called over-collateralization, they tried to make what was really junk paper look like AAA-rated paper. And as a result of it, a lot of people made fees in that process. And there are these things called collateralized debt obligations and other things that AIG was very involved in, and credit default swaps. AIG was very heavily involved in that whole channel. That fueled the acceleration of the subprime lending because there was such demand for that to make the fees for all the people in that system.
Now, here's an email from Greg that may represent the thinking of lots of taxpayers. He says, please make sure listeners understand there was zero financial need for taxpayers to bail out Fannie and Freddie. The people who own Fannie Freddie bonds should have taken all the losses, not the taxpayers. This is the way it works in all other bankruptcies. Treasury is stealing money from taxpayers for political gains. Doug?
There are probably two reasons why one can defend putting the taxpayers behind Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Number one would be they are so large in the financial system that they represent a systemic threat. If they go down, lots of other parts of the system go down as well.
We hear that a lot, that domino theory.
We can come back to that. But that's defense number one. The second defense is that many borrowers, particularly international borrowers, you know, sovereign countries, perceived their debt to be almost equivalent to U.S. Treasuries. And if somehow we forced the defaults on those, we'd have some international and diplomatic repercussions that would be undesirable. So the end result is we stepped in. I am less interested in that stepping in than the fact that the system was built to end up having us step in. This was a system where there was way too little capital behind these institutions. They had to hold essentially half what an institution normally held, where there was no particular public sector benefit to the guarantees that they got and the special privileges they got. And instead, we ended up with a highly leveraged, risky hedge fund that was ostensibly a government enterprise. That's
all right.
Crazy.
And Diane, just one point that I think it's important for homeowners to realize that a combination of actions by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration over the last almost now 2 years since the crisis began have mitigated how deep and severe the housing crisis is. And what we've seen during the crisis is how entwined the housing market is with the broader macroeconomy and jobs. And that is, people lost 30% of the wealth in their homes in this country over the last couple of years. But if they had lost more, and in some places there was real chance of the complete bottom falling out, worthless homes, unfortunately, the effect of that would have been on the consumption and the spillover, and it would have escalated to perhaps a recreation of the Great Depression.
All
so
right.
We've had some value in the interventions that the administrations have taken.
To New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I was hoping your guest could sort of refresh my memory on the history of Fannie and Freddie, and I believe it was one or the other at the beginning. In any case, I understood that it was originally a totally government agency, mm-hmm. and during the Vietnam War it was taken off budget or privatized or hybridized mm-hmm. in some way or the other. But at least in recent years, it struck me that it was more of a private entity than a government entity, you know, executives getting high salaries and then this hedge fund risk-taking and so on. And I'm just puzzled why it is that the group of people who tend to be anti-government, anti-regulation, are trying to blame this on a government agency when, in fact, it sounds like it was more like a private or partially unregulated entity.
Doug.
You've got the history right. It was originally a government agency. It was then, for budgetary reasons, pushed into the private sector. But in the process, they held on to some things to be able to use it for policy purposes. The Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had lines of credit at the Treasury. They had presidential appointees on their board. They did not have to register their securities with the SEC and undergo the usual due diligence. They did not have any limitations on the amount of their securities that community banks could hold, so that in the end we saw many bank failures because Fannie and Mae Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wiped out the value of their holdings. And so we had this peculiar hybrid that was set up to be a private entity but still held on to some public privileges. It was then given its own regulator, which didn't have much power and forced it to hold too little capital. I don't think if you're a staunch pro-government person, I don't think I'm in that camp, that you'd want to defend this. I don't think if you're a staunch private market person, which I am, you'd want to defend this. These were bad entities designed poorly and failed predictably.
All right, to Cassopolis, Michigan. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, I don't know, why couldn't we have a hybrid system with the banks, kind of like a land contract, whereas if you can't afford your home, then basically what you would be doing is renting. It's a mortgage with a rental. So instead of going into foreclosure, you basically you're renting. Because part of the problem is that through foreclosure could take months, whereas your house is sitting empty. Cities, municipalities, they're losing tax dollars. This way, if they do, then banks could turn around, put somebody right back into that house with the same mortgage payment. And, you know, it would then Fannie and Freddie could actually just back the amount of time that there was that the house was vacant.
Yeah. Now, in some cases, banks across the country are doing that, aren't they, Linda?
That certainly can be done. And that's one of the things this administration did early on through the Neighborhood Stabilization Program is push money out into cities and states and small local governments. And some of that money could have been used to create community land trusts where the government could have effectively allowed a nonprofit or another entity to go in and buy up that land and over the course of time protect that housing over the long term. Other efforts were put in place to protect renters in foreclosed properties, and that helps stabilize communities as houses are foreclosed upon.
All right. And Diane, in the system of the future, one of the things that we need to have is the ability for an institution, we've called in our proposal this the housing a finance innovation fund that could pioneer new products such as a shared equity product where a borrower goes into a home with a limited down payment but that there is also essentially an investment, and then as the property value appreciates, the value of the investment goes to subsidize future affordable housing. And there are a whole range of other innovative products like that where we can ensure that there is borrower skin in the game, that we can find ways to end for low and moderate income homebuyers who can be in the right products, successful homeowners, and we need to be able to have vehicles to test and pioneer some of those new strategies.
You look skeptical, Doug.
So this is back to the American obsession with owning homes and Sarah's remarkable defense of the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, which cannot exist under normal conditions, only exists because of a government subsidy of it in the United States. It's not around anywhere else in the world. It's another subsidy to home ownership in the United States.
What are you suggesting?
Why is it so scary that people might live in rental housing in the United States?
But, Doug, I think there's two things. One is in this society where we have a great deal of risk put on individual families, we don't have retirement security, we don't have a lot. Home ownership has been one of the ways in which people have acquired wealth. Now, we absolutely need to put more emphasis on rental housing. But for families to purchase a house and know that in 5 years that house could suddenly cost 30-40% more to sustain, the transaction costs for individuals to have to change your housing every 5 years if in a different interest rate environment. Investors can hedge that risk, and investors have much lower barriers to investment changes. So we really do need some kind of long-term vehicle so that people can have homes. Not everyone, but borrowers who can be successful in homeownership, it's part of the American society compact.
All right.
And then we'll stop squabbling. But all if right. investors can hedge the risk, investors can offer the 30-year fixed because there's no risk. So that
okay.
can't be right. And what Sarah's basically said is your retirement should be tied up in your house. That's a terrible retirement strategy.
All right.
Have a diversified portfolio.
Linda.
I guess I would say that these models of shared equity are extremely important when we're putting public dollars and public backing or public subsidy into these units. They perpetually keep the home affordable to the next occupants, which we think is a very reasonable way to go about subsidizing and supporting home ownership in the United States. We really have to take some steps, and hopefully through this housing reform, from looking at housing as a way to create and sustain wealth. The lowest income families who've got into home ownership over the last 10 years weren't moving into neighborhoods where those houses appreciated at the same rate as higher income people. And we need to recognize that housing in and of itself should be enough.
All right. On the line with us is a former Fannie Mae employee, Cindy, in Rockville. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm calling to kind of clarify a couple of things that I believe were misstated by your guests earlier, and also to just kind of make a general point.
Sure.
Firstly, I'm a former Fannie Mae employee. I left voluntarily. I'm not a huge fan of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac because of the financial issues that they ran into in the early part of the 2000s because of poor accounting systems and quite a bit of political challenges within the organizations. That said, the discussion around government guarantees of Fannie Mae and the lines of credit at the Treasury, when they had those lines of credit, they were, I think, at the maximum $2 billion, and Fannie Mae's portfolio back in 2004, 2005 was close to $1 trillion. So the theory that there was some sort of government backing presumption was largely a political argument used to try and de-government sponsor entity-ize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and privatize them into completely commercial banks, which were who they were competing with for most of the mortgages they were trying to buy. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999 created a market that essentially put the commercial banks who could generate mortgages and then turn around and securitize those themselves and sell them on the open market as direct competitors to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That caused a great deal of what ended up happening in the latter part of this decade with the subprime crisis that we all ran into. Entities like Washington Mutual, AIG, Lehman Brothers, you know, no one would have ever thought 15, 20 years ago that they would ever be rescued by the federal government. They were, in fact. So many of those arguments around the issues that are people that claim that solely were Fannie and Freddie that brought down the banking system and the mortgage markets is largely flawed for that very reason.
Cindy, thanks for your call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Talk about that Graham Leach bill.
Well, I want to go back and address the first thing, which is this is not with the benefit of hindsight. When I was at the Congressional Budget Office 2003, we did a number of studies, and I testified about the implicit taxpayer backing of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The line of credit wasn't the argument. It's one of the various array of things, of special privileges that those entities received that led to the impression that the government was going to back them. And you could see the impact in the market. If you took their borrowing versus a comparable real private sector entity's borrowing, they could borrow much more cheaply. The explanation was there was a perception by investors that they were going to have a safer investment in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because the government was behind them.
And
that's
did
it.
That
and that turned out to be true, as
did,
it turns out, very expensive
that
and true.
Put those smaller banks out of business.
It didn't put anybody out of business, but it allowed these entities to expand beyond a safe size. And probably the biggest thing we could have done would have been to cap their portfolio investments so that they were not so large and dangerous, and then go back and have the fight about whether you need the guarantee for public policy. That's a fight worth having. On the Graham-Leach-Bliley front, I just think it's important to recognize that it ratified the de facto operating in the United States. There's nothing about Graham-Leach-Bliley that changed what was going on. It was an acknowledgement that banks were able to operate in this way. It ratified what was going on, so it didn't cause these things. Other things preceded it.
So, quickly, in our last few seconds, what do you see coming out of these four conferences to be held?
I think the administration will weigh what they hear and come out with a proposal in January that will be the beginning of a debate with the Congress. I hope that there will be, ultimately, the Congress recognizes the interest of many Americans in having a sensible, balanced system and will get beyond the sort of ideological debate to a new regime.
Linda.
I think that that we'll see early next year the beginnings of a proposal and of a framework to ensure that every community is able to access in a fair and equitable way the housing options and the housing choices that are going to fit its community from the very lowest end to the highest end.
And, of course, that will be after the midterm elections, Doug. How is the Congress going to view this?
I think most of the races would suggest there are going to be more Republicans, if not control of houses of Congress. They will have a bigger say in the way this evolves. But for a long time, conservatives have wanted to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they are very politically durable. Even in the face of accounting scandals, things were unchanged. I think it's a dramatic change is needed. We'll see if it happens.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken of the American Action Forum, Sarah Rosen-Mortell at the Center for American Progress, Linda Couch of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Thank you all.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.